Okay, so welcome all to the observations at the interface of strong gravity and quantum gravity discussion session. So this is a panel. There is a panel for this discussion. So this is a panel discussion in principle. But I mean, in discussions with the panel, we've decided, of course, that we don't want to keep the discussion within the panel. The idea is that we all discuss together. The panel is just here to facilitate the discussion. And since we're a relatively small group, I think we should just all switch on our microphone when we need to speak and interject. If you're having trouble interjecting, just raise your hands and I'll stop the rest and give you the microphone if you need it. We've prepared just a few questions that we might want to address here. We didn't want to prepare the slides, any slides, because we want this to be a true discussion session. And I'll share the questions, more topics for discussion in a moment. Let me first go around and introduce the members of the panel, kind of in order of appearance in my screen. So this is Stefano Liberati from CISA. Stefano, you might want to wave. Nihaya Sassordi from PI. Mary Sakellariadu from KCL, and Alessia Platania from the University of Heidelberg. So as I said, I'll turn to them mostly when the discussion stalls, but if it's vibrant, I hope to hear less of them and more of the rest, if that's all right with everybody. Okay, so I'll share my screen, if I can find the right buttons. Okay, so hopefully you're seeing PowerPoint slide. So we are at an age, of course, where we're collecting a vast amount of data about strong gravity. This session is supposed to be in the interface of strong gravity and quantum gravity. My personal viewpoint is that the data we will collect from gravitational waves and other observations like black hole imaging, partial timing arrays or whatever else in the future will really transform, you know, gravity into a data-driven field. It will give us a lot of information. I'm not planning to review this data in this session, but of course we can discuss them. I think we're all exposed to the results and to the data. So I'd like to steer the discussion more towards how we actually understand this data and what do they mean for quantum gravity, which is the topic of the conference. So observations of strong gravity basically probe black holes and compact objects, and specifically their structure. So in a sense, the fundamental question that we could answer is black holes and compact stars, as general relativity describes them, or general relativity together with the standard model, to be more precise. Or are there deviations? So this is kind of the first and most important topic. It's in the structure of these objects and potential deviations from this structure that a deviation from general relativity and potentially, you know, some signature of quantum gravity might be hiding. That's how we're going to see it. This is in a sense a twofold question. On the one hand, there is how much have the observations have told us, given the fact that they have limited accuracy, and how much they will be able to tell us in the future, and also how much do we expect theoretically black holes and compact stars to differ from general relativity, and is that testable? Mm-hmm. The second topic. So I'll try to review briefly the topics, and then I'll open it up, and people can make comments. So I'll try to be as brief as possible. Then the second topic is: are black holes really black holes? Right. So you could have small deviations from the structure you expect, or you could have something very dramatic, like there is no horizon. Black holes are not really black holes. And can we actually test this in some way? And then there is another kind of big category of questions that one could ask, which relate to what kind of deviations could we possibly probe with observations. So strong gravity observations probe large astrophysical systems, right? So one could expect at least naively thinks to behave classically there. So one could ask the question, are classical deviations of GR really a probe of quantum gravity? And then one could also think about whether quantum gravity could actually introduce deviations at these scales that could be probable with either current or future observations. And that brings on the question, are current or future strong gravity observations a probe for quantum gravity? Finally, there is the question of suppose we detect some deviation in the objects that we probe. Suppose that we see something that we don't expect to see in the strong gravity regime. Does it actually tell us something about quantum gravity? We kind of concoct models which are motivated or inspired by quantum gravity candidates, but it's quite rare that we actually have a theoretical trail that goes all the way from the fundamental principles to low energy theories, right? So can we, if we were to detect something, could we use it in some way to learn something about quantum gravity? How would that be, right? So these are mostly themes, I would say, topics rather than concrete questions that I think we should be touching upon in this discussion session. But I'd like to keep it as open as possible. So I'll stop here and I'll pass it on to you. And if anybody wants to say something, not only the panel members, but anybody else, or ask a specific question that we should be discussing, just go for it. Okay, so we don't have any takers. So perhaps we should use our panel, and I'll go back to the first topic I raised. Stefano, would you like to comment on that? So do we think that black holes and compact stars are as we describe them with general relativity? Will there be deviations? Can we probe them?
I think that for what regards black hole, my tackle is that, I'm always convinced that black hole, as they are in GR, they cannot be completely physical, because we know that there are singularities inside black hole. These singularities somehow have to be dealt with by quantum gravity. Now, there is not only the singularity that I would like to see dealt with by a quantum gravity theory, but there is also sometimes Cauchy horizons. And also Cauchy horizons personally are something that I think a quantum gravity theory should be able to deal with. Otherwise, you don't have predictability. That for me is the most important feature that a full physical theory should have. I like, as a physicist, I like to make prediction and test them. So the point, I guess, is the first point that we should think in this respect is, can quantum gravity do the job and leave whatever we see in the exterior completely untouched? So basically, I think that there was a prejudice. Let me put it, I call it a prejudice in a provocative way, but I really think that it was a little bit of a prejudice, given that we don't have a theory of quantum gravity. The prejudice is the following, that yes, quantum gravity will solve this issue inside the horizon, but somehow it will do it locally, that there are no large scale in time and space effects with which quantum gravity will deal with the black hole Cauchy horizons and singularities. Now, in the few toy models that we have, I think that this is not the case. I mean, if you think, for example, at the tentative calculations in loop quantum gravity, where they find bounces. Bounces are an evident example where you have a large-scale effect in time and in space. It's true that for a long time you have a black hole or something that looks like a black hole, apart from the fact that also that, I think, is an object of discussion. The time scale over which you have the bounce can be also very short in some models. So it's just an example. I'm not supposing anything, but what I'm saying is that for black holes, I would like to see, and I never see, a bulletproof argument that quantum gravity can do the job without leading to large-scale deviations. Because if it does, if you have tails in the geometry, for example, between the horizon, then it's obvious. If you have this, when you do a black hole, white hole, you have always a region outside of the horizon, which is non-classical, in the sense that the metric is not the solution of the classical Einstein equation, cannot be. And it's clear why, because you're joining basically now lines have to do this at the black hole horizon. They peel away. At the white hole, they do this. And in order to match them in a continuous way, you need basically to have a non-classical regime. So this is a clear example where you have a large scale effect. Regarding COPPA stars, I have my impression, for example, is that there we haven't explored yet, for example, the role of torsion, which I think is too much neglected, given that there for sure you have to look at some point at gravity with fermions. And I would like really to understand if that, throwing an idea, I think that is something where we could explore.
You mean that fermionic matter could actually be feeding?
Could
torsion,
generate
torsion,
exactly,
basically.
Even if it doesn't propagate, even if you are in a theory where it doesn't propagate in vacuum.
So, I mean, just to potentially fuel the discussion, I mean, there is, in what regards your first comment, you could try to phrase it also in terms of new fields. You could say that, I mean, if there are new degrees of freedom associated with quantum gravity, then the assumption that anything that happens in quantum gravity in the interior doesn't leak in the outside requires locality and requires confinement, right, of these degrees of freedom. So I mean, if I put it in this way, I could buy it more easily for large astrophysical black holes, in the sense that you could say, oh, look, I could, you know, as long as they are confined enough to be inside the horizon when the horizon is at macroscopic scales, that might be good enough for me. But as the black holes become smaller, obviously, that would become less believable. But of course, there is the question, there is the point that you raised, that the Cauchy horizons are not sitting at the singularity. They're actually sitting at kind of, you can't really trust the picture, right? But they can be sitting significantly closer to the horizon.
Exactly.
In some mathematically non-meaningful way, though. I mean, so we have to be.
And I interject for a second. So there's a question of what could be, and then the other is what should be. And there is this kind of new, movement in people who, I guess, traditionally did a string theory but worked on an information paradox. And there were discussion of this in the first day, which I didn't quite catch all of it. But there is this idea that there's a way of understanding the black hole evaporation and solving the information paradox purely semi-classically. And I just was wondering what is your take on that? Stefano, I know you were in that session. I didn't catch all of that session, but I'm just wondering, I mean, that was one of the motivations, basically by firewall paradox was one of the motivations for having stuff happening at the horizon, basically significant deviations from GR at the horizon. Now, is there, do you guys have any idea is that paradox is still like kind of a standing, or are people have moving away from that?
But the firewall, you mean? The firewall.
Yeah. So, I mean, this is the stuff people talk about solving the information paradox using some holographic picture. I mean, does that sound like
someone else was, in the information loss panel, they were basically using this idea of the islands. That means that there is some kind of strong non-locality in the computation that leads to the purity of the state that you see close to Sky Plus, which has to do with taking into account degrees of freedom which are behind the horizon. Mm-hmm. The strong non-locality indeed can be related to the discussion that we're having here. I don't know for sure. You know, to me, the problem is that basically they are going kind of say they're taking into account some Hawking partners. And of course, you know that if you can do that, you can purify the radiation, because at the end they are created in a squid state. So the problem is that somehow it may be that is just a proxy. This is what I say in that session, to take into account that these are stuff that is going in the quantum gravity region, because they're falling in the quantum gravity region. Maybe it's a way to say that there is a correlation between the quantum gravity degrees of freedom and the outside degrees of freedom. And with this correlation, you can purify the radiation. It's just a proxy to look at this island. But still, it is a strong form of non-locality. So you see, even if you accept a concept like that, it seems to me that it's a prejudice to be sure to say quantum gravity has to do the job to remove the singularity, but you always do so in such a way that we cannot probe it from outside. that seems to me, you know, the example you just called in from the information loss part is exactly the contrary. That is an observation you do semi-classical outside, which is strongly influenced by stuff that is happening inside and which is ending up probing a quantum gravity region. So, you see, it seems to me that then the models are moving in the opposite directions. And if you want to regularize singularity and remove Cauchy horizon, you can do it with very basic assumption about what quantum gravity should do. I would insist that it's very difficult to keep everything local.
Mm-hmm. I totally agree.
Yeah. I mean, depends a bit on.
Go ahead.
No, I mean, I think this depends a bit on what is the structure that you have inside the horizon. So, assuming you have an horizon, you could have different structures inside. You could have something like a regular black hole, or you could have something like. In principle, also something with a singularity in the sense that there is a divergence of curvature invariance, but the singularity is integrable and therefore you don't have problems with geodesic completeness and predictability, and you don't have any Cauchy horizon. And in that case, I don't know if you could see anything from the outside.
Can I ask you something? So which exact definition do you follow for black holes in quantum gravity?
Because I think
it's an important question. That's an important question, no? If we want to see whether we can find any kind of quantum gravity, we shouldn't carry the same definition that we had in classical GR.
But even in classical GR, only kind of mathematically robust definition of black holes is global. So still, you know, it's hard in it's kind of an idealistic teleological definition rather than a practical definition that you can use. And you could find loopholes in definition even within a classical regime. So
I wanted to point out that there are many different definitions that not everybody uses the same one, and certainly it's not the one that astrophysicists use. So that's.
But
that's...
I guess, Mayiri, what you can do is the following: imagine we have a collapse that is forming a black hole, a large black hole. Even a large black hole must be regularized. At the end of the day, it doesn't matter how big it is. So you can still define an horizon locally with the trapping horizon. You say that one of the two expansion, the ongoing expansion has to be zero. And then you can characterize it even further with the layer derivative of the expansion as you go inside among the other geodesic, right? But so you can characterize locally the fact that you have a trapped region. Now, the point is, once you have characterized this and you are in a region, so imagine a sufficiently large black hole that the curvature is not... enormous there, you are at the horizon, everything is mild, then the point is quantum gravity has at some point to avoid, for example, if you are forming a Kerr black hole, you have to avoid the deformation of the inner horizon, because otherwise you are not predictive. Quantum gravity has to kick in, first of all, if you accept this, it has to kick in a scale which are much larger than the Planck scale. You don't need to get to the Planck scale. Or if something happens at the Planck scale and then somehow destroys from inside the Cauchy horizon. I mean, this is another possibility, different scenario, but whatever you want, if you want to have a regular solution all the way through without the Cauchy horizon, it's not that you have an infinite amount of possibilities. And it also implies that somehow the region that is affected by quantum gravity is a large region, it's not an ultra-local region at the Planck density at the Planck scale. And one comment about Alessia, regular black hole, for example, are a solution, but they are unstable generically because you have a mass inflation, because you need an inner horizon, and the inner horizon is unstable under mass inflation. And of course, you can have singularity which are milder, in the sense that you have the first derivative of the metric is okay, so the geodesic equation is okay, second derivative is not, the curvature blows up. But my impression, but this is a prejudice, is that you have to fine-tune the theory. Somehow, if you think of a dynamical collapse, it's really weird that you end up in one of these fine-tuned solutions where you keep the first derivative okay, but then is the second derivative blows up. No? It seems that I don't see any physical compelling reason to expect that. So it would be interesting if quantum gravity always lead to this kind of outcome.
So
there is a raised hand.
There is a raised hand by, I think, Russo.
Yeah, Stefan, hello. Is a black hole singularity necessarily of quantum origin? Why I'm asking the question? Because do you dismiss necessarily the possibility to have a dissipative, time-dependent classical structure instead of a quantum?
But still, it would be a quantum origin, the dissipative, because dissipation, what it means that you are losing energy to fundamental degrees of freedom that you are not able to collect, no? So in the sense that you are coarse graining from over, so you need to take into account in this case, in order to have a dissipation when you get closer to the would-be singularity, you need somehow to exchange, to transform your matter degrees of freedom in a gravity one. That is the way you see dissipation in the matter dispersion relation. So it is a possible outcome, but somehow from the point of view of space-time, it would be still a regular solution. So if you just look at the principle with which the categorization that you can do will include something like that, your solution will get rid of the necessity to stop the matter or to not have it bouncing.
So you have
I agree with you.
So you have to modify the Einstein equation and the energy momentum tensor temu to include the dissipative term?
In principle, if you want to do back reaction as well, but that is very, nobody knows how to do it, really, I think.
Did someone try to infer energy momentum tensor, including dissipative term based on symmetry argument? This is what we do in fluid mechanics, for example. When we switch to Euler equation, to Navier-Stokes equation, we modify the energy momentum tensor by adding a dissipative term, and then we plug it into the...
Yeah, it would be a term which has a derivative in time and derivative in space. So that is what normally generates a modified dispersion relation with dissipation. The problem is that I guess that you will have a problem with conservation of the stress energy tensor, and then you don't have a consistent theory of gravity because you have a Einstein tensor on the left and a non-self stress energy tensor on the right. You need to go to resort to the fundamental theory.
So if you modify T mu nu, you have to modify J mu nu as well, the Einstein tensor.
Yes. Yes.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Thanks.
So can we test all this? I mean, in any way? So we've been discussing about the fact that we want to resolve the singularity problem, basically, either... You know, whether that singularity sits on the Cauchy horizon or further inside, I think is not particularly important for this discussion, but we want to resolve that singularity and perhaps that leaks out. Does it leak out classically or you know, quantum mechanically? Do I have to have a quantum region outside, or is it just a classical leak? And can I test it in some way? I mean, which relates also to the question of are black holes, and can I test that they actually have horizons? You know, do they need to have horizons if the singularity is resolved, right? Because we end up in a little bit of a circular argument here. Oh, we assume the cosmic censorship conjecture, and hence classically, and there is a horizon. Then inside sits a singularity. Then we resolve the singularity. Then we keep the horizon. But anybody care to comment on this?
I mean, I don't know how you would form, for example, ultra-compact object, because in a semi-classical collapse, there isn't, if it is free-falling, as it will most probably will be, there is nothing that is going to stop the collapse. But so I would expect that generically you form always a trapped region. Then it's a different matter if the regularization of the singularity can lead you to a bounce, to an anti-trapped region. So that is a different issue. But let's assume for a moment that you have mimickers which are ultra-compact object for some reason. Then my impression is that if the object has a surface which is very, very close to the horizon, to the would-be horizon, and so well inside the light ring, then I would tend to say that it's extremely, extremely, extremely difficult to distinguish this object from a black hole. I mean, The only counter example to this, I think, is the echo. The echoes could be, but I have a kind of objection, as you know, Thomas. I don't think that the echoes can be treated as linear perturbation if you have an ultra-compact object. My argument is that if you have an energy density hitting this surface, even a small energy density, even if you're really very close to the would-be horizon, you have to peel off. So small energy density here becomes an high energy density here. So my idea is that probably what is going to happen is the following. If the object is very compact, even small initial incoming gravitational waves go in a nonlinear regime. So that, I don't know the answer. I don't know if there isn't an echo, but I don't think that the linear analysis apply. Well, if you are in something that is not too compact, then probably the events are like LIGO, you can try to look for echoes. And those are objectively one of the few things I can think of that would be sensitive even to ultra-compact objects. But if you think, for example, you know that the constraint they were casting with accretion and then re-emission, there was Broderick and Narayan saying that Sagittarius A star cannot have a surface. They were forgetting the lensing, the fact that they're escaping, the probability of escaping from an ultra-compact surface, then angle close with the compactness parameter. So as the compactness go to the black hole one, the angle of escaping close to zero smoothly. There isn't a discontinuity. It's not a, all these properties seems to be continuous, not discontinuous. So it would make very, very difficult to fix this object, to constrain this object.
Nias or anybody else that cares to share an opinion on this?
So I guess since we're not supposed to bring a slide, I put one in my background. You can see echoes on top of my head.
Yes, you have the echoes on the head.
Echo, second.
That's
echo.
Cheating, yes. That's not what we agree.
Yes. Well, it's an artistic impression of echoes. So I think it's not scientific. So that's okay. It's not cheating. Yeah. So I think Stefano brought up a very good point about basically whether you could treat this linearly. And I think the answer is indeed correct that you cannot. And what you can do is you can phenomenologically quantify this as saying that if there is a surface where nonlinear quantum effects happen, can we quantify the reflectivity of the surface? And it is basically an observable of quantum gravity, which is basically if I scatter waves of subfrequency off the horizon, how much of it would come out and how much of it would be absorbed? Now, exactly how you can calculate it, that I think does require an actual genuine quantum gravity calculation, which could be nonlinear. In every sense, it could be nonlinear in terms of a strong coupling or in terms of basically large quantum effects. But it's something that could be there, and there is no obvious answer that what it's going to be. So our proposal, our thesis is that in fact, for all the reasons that, Stefano is a skeptical of seeing echoes, you won't be able to see them at high frequencies because you are basically in the geometric optics regime, and particles basically just cannot get out because of this small escape angle. But for low frequencies where you are not in a geometric optics regime, where you basically you have large wave packets, then they can more easily be reflected. And one has to do a nonlinear calculation, but we have kind of some guesses as to how they may turn out. And basically, I think it is a prediction that should come out of your theory of quantum black holes, and it's not a straightforward one, and it could depend on frequency. And the answer could very well be at high frequencies, black holes are really black holes, and at low frequencies, lower than the Hawking temperature, then they're not really black. And that's really what you need to solve things like information paradox or be consistent with, say, event horizon telescope observations. Reflectivity at low frequencies, I think, is phenomenologically viable. But exactly what it is, I think you have to have a good model understanding. And if it's there, you could go and test it.
Apart from Stefano's your concern. There is also seems to be also some implicit assumption here that this object, whatever it is, it is remarkably similar to a black hole of GR, apart from the fact that it doesn't have a horizon, which basically means that kind of the exterior carries no imprint of the interior structure. And we know that this is not true for horizonless objects in GR, right? I mean, you know, if I have a neutron star, I can actually tell some things about the interior. The interior structure is printed in the exterior space-time, basically, right? So you know, wouldn't that also be an issue with all of, at least at the practical level, for the approximations that people have employed, right? This is also seems to be kind of an over simplification of the problem, that all I have is basically kind of a GR-like signal that bounces off in a different way on the horizon, because the horizon can be permeated to some level, and also, of course, there is the question of what the horizon does to the signal once it reflects it. I mean, it doesn't have to just reflect it or not reflect it, or, you know, it can scramble it up. So.
Not only, but I would expect that this object must have a very high absorption, because you see, they need to react in order to be stable. They need to expand every time you accrete stuff on it. Mm-hmm. And there is and if they expand casual way, causality basically puts a limit on how fast they can expand. So you can even draw a limit on how much accretion you can have without have a causal expansion. So if they need to be always stable, you need to have some kind of non-local physics going on, I would say. So in a certain sense, before the matter reach the object should start to react in a certain sense.
That's why I was talking about the wave nature of, the wave. So if you think about these as particles that falling in, then indeed the problem is what you say is that they cannot be reflected before they actually become trapped. But if you're talking about waves, then it's going to be harder to actually quantify this, because, I mean, waves are not local.
Because you don't have the right optic approximation, you would
That's
say, for
right.
the wavelength.
That's right.
But still, I think that my argument can be recast, even if you are not using gray optic approximation. I don't know. I have to think about it, but
it becomes a bit harder to put, because I mean you don't have like simple like spherical approximations if you're something that's have low frequency, long wavelength, and it's oscillating. And our general arguments that based on things like detailed balance, for example. They suggest that, in fact, that's when where geometric optics fails is where you can get large reflectivity. But for where geometric optics works very well, then you get actually exponentially suppressed reflectivity. So that's a separate line of argument, but I think that would be consistent with what you're saying.
I wanted to do a comment. I don't know, Thomas, if I'm allowed, because we are talking always about black hole now, but I don't think that strong gravity is exhausted there. For example, we have a question that is, can current and future gravitational waves observation probe quantum gravity? For example, one question that I would like to raise is the following. I mean, we can indirectly see primordial gravitational waves to B modes, right? And we have models that are supposed to be models of quantum gravity. I'm thinking, for example, of Rava gravity, where you have a scale of Lorentz breaking in this case, which by other consistency requirement has to be below the Planck scale. So the Planck energy, sorry. What I mean is that one provocative question is, couldn't we be able, imagine that you have that the scale for Rava gravity is 10 to the 16 GeV, and you have that the scale of inflation is 10 to the 16 GeV. In that case, the usual argument that tells you that in the power spectrum, you have a suppression that goes like the scale of inflation to the scale of the new physics, at least a square, then it seems to me that you have a ratio that goes to one. So why we shouldn't be able to probe this kind of scenarios with B modes? I know that they are not directly gravitational waves, so I don't know if it is. But why, for example, is not possible to? I mean, shouldn't we try to look more in these other directions?
I think people have been looking for B modes, and trying to find them. So if we find them, we can probably answer that question, but we haven't really.
but you know, as you know, they have been constrained from the B modes, also from the string theory scenarios. I mean, I will highlight a bit in the talk afterwards. So there are these swamplet scenarios where you can see that there are constraints which they come from the air modes as well. Now, about the quantum gravity and gravitational waves, you said some constraints have been put to a few models, actually. And this comes when you go to compare the luminosity distance as you get it from the strain and as you get it from, you know, from the electromagnetic counterpart. So there are attempts in order to do that. The problem, however, which I think still exists, is that whatever we're doing from the point of view of cosmology, it is not for the full quantum gravity theory, which we don't have, but for the model which comes from the full theory. So at sometimes can be helpful because you can go back and, you know, this might help for model building for the quantum gravity model. But it's true that finally what we test is not the full theory itself, which we do not have, but what, you know, a model which is motivated from the full theory.
And a model, you mean an effective field theory?
An effective field theory, yeah, whatever. I mean, you know, you take LQC, for instance, you take a GFC, you take a string theory model. You don't have the full theory, and you freeze half of the degrees of freedom, if even more, and then you work with the rest. So these are, you know, it can be a mini superspace approach, can be effective field theory, but whatever you do is not the full theory because we don't have it. So then we go back and sometimes we extrapolate what we learn from this effective approach to the full field. I'm not saying that there is another way to do it. We don't have another way to do it, so this is very good. And then you can go back, you know, and this might help in order to modify. You know, you cannot wake up tomorrow and have the full theory of quantum gravity. But it's true that sometimes we carry what we know for a classical theory in a quantum gravity kind of scenario. That's why I asked before, what is the definition of a black hole for a quantum gravity context? We don't know, we don't have it. So again, we take something we know for classical GR and we try to apply it. So that's a bit dangerous. I'm not saying that we can do better, but we have to keep that in mind.
I think, Thomas, this is related to one of the points.
I have a question for the group. It goes in a slightly different direction, so feel free to redirect me. And I also arrived late, so I apologize if you already covered this. But there are these two recent LIGO events that we've heard more about, GW 1904-25 and 1908-14, with compact objects in the mass gap. And there's a kind of emerging discussion as to whether they're primordial black holes. And I was curious whether people have opinions one way or the other about that.
I mean, I have seen the papers and the discussion about the possibility of primordial black holes. And this could be, you know, this could be a case, but can be as well an exotic object which we don't know. So, the
mass gap is not incomplete, right?
Yes, we don't know all details. You know, we came up about a few days ago in a suggestion of primordial black holes, which can be formed by the cusps in a cosmic string, because you have that region that you know, can fulfill the hoop conjecture. I'm not saying the whole loop to collapse. This cannot be done, has to be circular and that, but you can have the cusp. And then you can have a variety of spectrum of masses of primordial black holes, then they could be the primordial black holes that have been suggested by this paper, you say, by Sebastian Cassin and Juan García Bellido, or you can have, so you can have mechanisms to be primordial black holes, but it can be also another exotic object which we don't know. So I think the question from a point of view of either astrophysics, if you wish, is open, and that's very interesting.
I completely agree, Mary, but I guess I'm partly asking about your Bayesian estimate. What's your current thinking? What's your bias at the moment?
I cannot tell you. There is just a couple of events. It's very difficult to say what it is. It's quite premature to say what it is. We know what it is not, but what it is, I cannot, you know. Primordial black holes is something that, to my mind, sounds pretty plausible. So I would, you know, I would say that this could be, I mean, from what I've seen, primordial black hole, something very easily that you can form. Yet, as I said, we found a new mechanism. So primordial black hole is something that could be. But I could not exclude that is something, you know, more exotic than that, than we don't know. So
clear. But are there other opinions?
Is if it's something even less exotic, which is just a regular black hole, as Thomas mentioned in the mass gap. And I mean, the problem is that our understanding of whatever happens in a stellar astrophysics has been kind of evolving very rapidly with every new LIGO event. Like the first LIGO event was not predicted, that having black holes that massive, and yet we saw them. So the question is, I guess if it's just an ordinary black hole, because you can make them, there's nothing in GR that tells you you cannot make a small black hole. And a stellar astrophysics is complicated. So
I would agree with you. I would agree just 1 second with you that from the GR point of view, there is nothing to stop them. But then we should see from an astrophysical point of view, I have no clue whether so small black holes could be formed. This is something that has to be investigated. I mean,
there is a reason why there is this, you know, this is called the mass gap. And obviously kind of conventional astrophysics suggests that you cannot do it. But I think I would personally agree a lot with Nias's last statement that, I mean, we should discriminate between what we think that based on current theory is impossible, which of course, even there we should be open-minded because it's current theory. That's why I phrase it in this way, right? But, you know, it's one thing that established theory says this should not happen. And it's another thing that says, oh, look, if I take established theory with some conjectures about astrophysics and you know, good empirical models and so on and so forth, and I put them together, it's unlikely that objects of this size exist, right? Which I think is what the mass gap is about in my reading. If that's a very personal statement, if I had to put my money on this, I would not buy that as evidence of an exotic object over just a small black hole, unless I see strong evidence for the former. So, mm-hmm. But again, that's a personal.
If I may say, I share your. I think we should be prudent and not be, you know, the kind of community that goes after each single odd event, in the sense that I've seen here we had people working, for example, in nuclear astrophysics, the equation of state for neutron star is a matter of research and debate. It's not clear if you can have also component with strange quarks and so on. So, for example, even about how massive a neutron star can be, I think that there is some uncertainty. We shouldn't take things, you know, too sharply. Similarly, I think that also what we know about the mass of the black hole is in astrophysics has a lot of uncertainty. So I think that it's important that the strong gravity community doesn't start doing what, phenomenology in particle physics sometimes does. Now, when there is an anomaly, there is this rush. I think that one has to keep cold blood, take into account that the event is interesting, waiting for better data, see if there is a statistic, if there are many of these, and then you have a better accuracy. We shouldn't take too critically what comes from LIGO and Virgo.
I agree, because remember the case of the superluminary neutrinos and all the papers that came the day after.
I know very well.
They had to be retrieved. people are very happy when they see that their number of, citation increase with a paper that makes no sense. Nevertheless, I think that it's interesting from every point of view to examine what is the origin of that. And as I said before, the idea of a primordial black hole is not really exotic. It's something that goes more along the lines of what we know. Now, it's also true that from what I hear from people involved more with astrophysics, you do not know, what is the history for a star, for the evolution, how a black hole can be formed. As you know, this is even open to investigation. So all these astrophysical models are quite, unclear up to now what's the correct one. So there is an uncertainty that has to be seen from every point of view. But
I completely agree with the caution that everybody is expressing. But I'm very interested in what we can learn about black holes that may be primordial, partly because of a connection with quantum gravity, as I've argued with Eugenio Bianchi and Anuruddha Gupta and Satya Prakash. If we knew that a black hole was formed in microcanonical equilibrium, then we can argue very strongly that it should have zero spin. And so black holes that are primordial are much more, it's much easier to see how they could be formed in microcanonical equilibrium. And then it's much easier to make a connection to this argument about the Bekenstein-Hawking entropy and the degrees of freedom. So, if we had a black hole that was less than a solar mass, I think everybody would say it was probably primordial. And that gives a really interesting cross-correlation between the mass of the black hole and the spin of the black hole that makes this connection with, you know, microstates of Bekenstein-Hawking entropy very compelling. And so I'm very, very intrigued by what we can say about the primordial nature of any black hole.
As you said, the spin is something very important. So the problem is that up to now with LIGO, we're not very precise in determining the spin, but the spin is something very, very important. The spin, and if you have many such observations, their location with respect to the galaxy catalogs can tell you something about their origin. Mm-hmm. So the distribution will be different if there are of astrophysical origin or if there are primordial black holes. So this is something that can give you information. But again, this is a work that has not been done.
Yeah.
And you need many more events. With a couple of them, statistics is zero, so we cannot say more.
There is degeneracy, right, in the measurement of the spin. So, I mean, somehow...
Yeah, there is degeneracy. There is degeneracy. Of sources,
you can't, within one source, you cannot say anything, I think, because of the degeneracy.
No, it's next. Statistics is zero. So, there is whatever is said is premature. That's why I think everybody is very cautious, even though there are proposals like the paper that you mentioned before.
Well, and these recent events with large mass ratios are fascinating because you get a much better constraint on the spin of the large black hole as well, right?
Yeah, so that's another thing. I mean, mm-hmm. So spin, indeed, I agree with you, is something that will be quite determinant in order to, you know, make the distinction of the origin.
Yeah.
So I mean, based on this last question that generated a question in my mind, which is, I would have thought that what Hal said would be how we can tell that these black holes are of primordial origin. So somehow, you know, what are the telltale signs that this is a primordial black hole? I mean, I would have thought that the absence of the spin or the arguments that were brought forward would be how we can tell that they're primordial, right? So when does the argument become kind of cyclic?
Mm-hmm. I agree with you. That's why I brought up the issue of cross-correlating with the mass. You know, if we found a black hole that was substellar mass or subsolar mass, I think we would say it's primordial. I really don't know of any.
I don't agree with you. I'm sure.
Okay. Yeah. So I'm interested. The model.
I'm sure we should be able to invent a model astrophysically to give you subsolar mass black holes. I mean, supernova explosions are violent processes, and they are unstable. And you could imagine that there is some small region that actually becomes trapped, and it's not a very big region. I mean, I don't think there is any fundamental. I mean, it's a turbulent process, right? So I don't think you could predict exactly what comes out of it.
Yes, and simulation are still not so advanced about. Simulating core collapse supernova. This is why, for example, there were some models in where they were expecting much more anisotropy and dense, for example, emission of gravitational waves. There was the expectation that you could have events from supernova, no? Which now it seems that statistically, instead, we are not seeing so frequent. Well, we're not seeing. I think we have never seen anything. So it looks like it's much more symmetric than it was supposed to be in some of the models, but the models which are more symmetric are more trouble to fit other data in the supernova. So I think we have still so large uncertainties. And also I would say it would be striking if we see a non-spinning black hole, but a primordial black hole can become spinning by some accretion event during its life. So Of course, it would be a smoking gun if you find a non-spinning one, but I would be very surprised that you can find one.
But I mean, again, this large mass ratio event, the larger black hole, it has a chi of 0.07. I mean, like, how many digits of non-spinning do you want before you say it's not spinning, right? That's extremely low.
So, yeah, I mean, but on the other side, why 0.7 is low, but it's not so bad. I mean, I don't understand your point. I mean,
I don't understand your point. Like, how many digits of zero do you want before you say it's not spinning? That we're never going to be able to say that to six digits, right?
No, but something that is very close to 0.1, I mean, it would be already telling you that it was probably something, even if it is really 0.1, it's probably that it was something non-spinning that was spun up
misheard me. They've constrained it to be 0.07.
Ah, plus, you said 0.7.
Plus minus?
Okay.
Plus or minus 0.07. I mean, it's consistent with zero.
So are you saying that astrophysically it's hard to get black holes with lower spin?
Yes.
Why?
Because accretion, you know, if it's an accretion disk, it tends to spin it in the direction of the accretion.
But jets tends to spin down the.
But that's not efficient, I don't think.
But I mean,
there are better experts in the room than me, so please speak up.
But based on what I've seen, there are these things called, I guess they call it MADS, I think, at Christa. They basically magnetically arrested disks, where they could be, basically, the efficiency of jets could be bigger than one. And these are models that Ramesh Narayan and others have worked on. So if you have large enough magnetic fields, then they could remove a spin much, much more efficiently. And so, I mean, otherwise all the quasars should have a spin of 0.99, and we measure their spin, and some are big and some are small, because I mean, they're all accreting, right? So, I mean, the idea there is that the jets, so accretion can spin things up, efficient accretion, but less efficient accretion leads to these jets that could spin down the black holes. And
I agree with you, Nayesh, but take, for example, the population of X-ray binaries that we know.
Yep.
And the spins of those X-ray binaries are between 0.15 and 0.97, something like that.
Right.
And then you take the population of LIGO black holes, and you know they're all consistent with things less than 0.15. Not all, I'm exaggerating. But the vast majority of the population is consistent with things that are smaller than the smallest.
This is consistent with what I'm saying, is that if you have efficient accretion, that tends to spin things up. But if you have not inefficient accretion, that tends to spin things down. If that is the trend, although that's kind of my recollection, because my recollection is that your efficient accretion, you don't make very big jets, but less efficient accretion, you get these big jets that can spin things down. And so that, I mean, something like that could be there in principle. Now, I don't think anybody understands the details very well, but we are talking about two different populations, population of things that you see as X-ray binaries are the things that keep accreting. And the things that you see in LIGO are things that are probably isolated, or at least has been isolated for a long time.
I would tend to think that this argument, I mean, comparing populations observed with different systems, would actually generically hint towards different astrophysics rather than, you know, different fundamental physics or whatever else you want to call it, because that's exactly where all of the environmental, you know, all of these selection bias effects when you're observing with a specific instrument and a specific system, right? So I mean, obviously that's not conclusive in any sense, but I mean, this is something I think we should be taking into account.
Yes.
I think we've just passed the mark of the hour. So, I'd be happy to go on for a little bit if people want to, but we should start thinking about wrapping up. Is anybody, that has some pressing questions?
I had a lot of questions, but I don't know if, because my concern...
We can discuss for a few minutes more if we want, from what I've been told by the organizers. So,
I had just one last question to your opinion. I mean, imagine that how we distinguish modifications that are introduced by true quantum gravity effect with respect to modified classical theories of gravity. Isn't in an inherent degeneracy? Is it going just the scale at which the effects are ruled that is going to tell us something? Because, you know, Mayri was talking about the effective field theory deriving from quantum gravity, but is really what one concern I have is this, that in, at the end we will, phenomenologically, you will always have this ambiguity. You may interpret one observation as new degrees of freedom which dawn in some gravity regime that normally we don't see and that are modifying your gravity, classical gravity theory, but you are well within the effective field theory low energy regime. Eh? Or there is some modification on large scale introduced by some dramatic quantum gravity regularization of singularity or something like that that leads to a large scale effect. So how we distinguish really the two situations? Alessia has an answer.
Yes. So I don't have an answer, but maybe I can express my point of view. So I think in general, classically, you would expect to have modifications to the Eisen-Hilbert action in terms of higher derivative terms. And as soon as you have observations from cosmology or from strong gravity phenomena, you can put some constraints on the form of your classical action or see it as an effective action. But the point is, in that case, you would constrain your action, but you would basically have a model that works for all the observations that we have, but you don't have an explanation for those terms in the action. And I think this would be somehow a way to go in the sense that if you try to combine the observations that you have to constrain your action or effective action, and a theory of quantum gravity can come up with an effective action in terms of a metric and some operators that could also be non-local, then you could somehow test some of the theories at least for the lower derivative terms. And in particular, the theory of quantum gravity should not really provide models, one that work for cosmology and one that work for black holes, but there should be something more. And I'm not saying that it's easy to do, but it might be a way. And in this sense, you could still have degeneracy between the theories of quantum gravity. There might be a set of theories that have maybe different effective action, different description, but similar predictions or postdictions, and the other set of theories that come up with effective actions whose effective quantum solutions are not compatible with what you observe. So in this sense, classical measuring a classical deviation from GR would be model building, while from quantum gravity you would expect to have an explanation for those deviations.
I mean, I largely kind of share the perspective of Alessia's perspective in the sense that, you know, I think most people that work on classical deviations from GR and alternative theories of gravity, they view what they do in this sense as doing some model building to understand what the possibilities are beyond GR and hopefully having these deviations eventually explained in the context of some mm-hmm. more fundamental model. I think there is also kind of no doubt in my mind that I could mimic with some classical theory, you know, a lot of quantum effects with that I can measure with finite accuracy, right? And never know what the true origin is unless my experiment is particularly sensitive in probing mm-hmm. certain features, right?
There is your paper about F of R action to mimic loop quantum cosmology.
But I mean, there is something actually that, you know, perhaps of more substance here, which is that, I mean, when we construct these classical models, we put some assumptions about what is realistic and what is not, right? And if you do view these models as Alessia actually nicely put it, as some parameterization over a wide range of scales of what could be going wrong so that I can combine observations all the way from cosmology to black holes, right? Which is my personal viewpoint. Yes. Then the point is you could make them do crazier or less crazy stuff. And what you consider acceptable or not does come from some sort of vague understanding of what you want quantum gravity to be, right? And relates in this way. And we know that once you turn on quantum effects, matter can violate energy conditions. It can behave in ways that would be classically unacceptable. So it is hard to define where you draw the line, right? And I mean, for instance, this compact object, this exotic compact objects or non-black holes or whatever else, are part of this. Like in most alternative theories, you can show that there are similar theorems like the singularity theorems or whatever else, and it seems particularly hard to construct something that is a non-black hole, right, and half collapse, even in the context of a fully kind of sensible classical alternative theory of gravity. So I don't know where to draw the line, and what you know.
Mm-hmm. Sure, but I think that if you have a theory or a model, you can somehow adjust your parameters to try to fit observations. But of course, if you are modifying your theory too much, modifying a large number of things, then it would be somehow, too fine-tuned. And that is probably something that one should avoid. One should try to describe the physical phenomena that you observe with the less number of parameters or adjustment possible. So if you can have three theories that give exactly the same predictions, but in one you have to fine-tune a lot, in another one you have 20 parameters, and in another one you have only two parameters, then one might go for the simplest that can explain what you have, the observation that you have at that moment.
I mean, I think that's definitely true, but it also depends on what people include in these observations. So for instance, a lot of these models are motivated by dark matter, dark energy, and so on. And the question, and of course, the point of disagreement between people is whether these observations should be included, and if they're included, whether they are explained or not, whether you're satisfied by sticking a number in and saying this is the number, you know, is it fine-tuning, is it not fine-tuning, and you know, is it stable to quantum corrections? So I think we should slowly wrap up because we've already gone 10 minutes over time. Thanks to everybody for participating. I hope this discussion was helpful, and have fun.
Yeah, it was very interesting. Thank you for organizing it.
And thanks very much to the panel members.
Thank you.
Thank you all. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Bye.